Now, just a few months ago, President Trump called California a disgrace to our country. A disgrace? Just think about that. The President of the United States, called the biggest state in the union with the most diversity and one of the strongest economies a disgrace. Well, I have to tell you, that bothers me, not as a Democrat, but as an American. The president is not supposed to be the head of a party, but the head of the whole country. And I'm tired of being of this country being a place where we don't talk to each other and where the president just divides us.
Former New York City mayor and presidential candidate Michael Bloomberg making the case to California voters why they should pick him to take on Donald Trump in 2020. Bloomberg spoke in Stockton yesterday after getting Mayor Michael Tubbs' endorsement. He also appeared alongside former California Governor Jerry Brown at a climate talk, although Brown did not endorse him. Bloomberg, a billionaire many times over, is going all in on California, especially after Senator Kamala Harris dropped out of the race. The Sacramento Bee's Brian Anderson was at that Stockton event where he asked Bloomberg a question that's gotten some attention. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Great to have you. Okay, so your question, how much does a gallon of milk cost? And here's what he said.
You know, I was talking about that the other day when I was mayor. We very carefully, every year, had to check on eggs and milk. I think a gallon is now about $5.
Okay, $5, that's not quite. Maybe if you're buying super duper organic milk, right?
I mean, it depends part of the country, too. Maybe it's more expensive in New York than it is in California and different parts of the country, and depending on the brand. But a little high, but in some places it could be right.
Okay. So basically, what do you think his reception was like here as you followed him?
Well, it felt like a little bit of a lukewarm reception. We had some people who were attending the joint news conference between Stockton Mayor Michael Tubbs and 2020 candidate Michael Bloomberg, who were not completely in on Bloomberg. At this stage in California's election, there's still a plethora of voters who are choosing between candidates, and Bloomberg's on the list of a few of them.
Right. So a CNN poll came out today and basically shows in California, Biden leading, followed closely by Sanders and then Warren. Bloomberg is at just 5%. He's really low on the list. Is that just because he's new to the race?
Well, I think a lot of it is voters are still trying to know who he is in California. That in an expensive state like California, it can be hard to get your name out there in the first place. We saw that with Pete Buttigieg polling in the low single digits when he started out, and that CNN poll had him at 9% in California. So in a state like this, it could take some time for some of these lesser known candidates to really get out there because half of the battle's just being known.
Yeah. Well, talking about the Mayor Michael Tubbs endorsement, Stockton's mayor endorsed him, and which may be a little surprising because one of his signature policies is the universal basic income. And that's one of the policies put forward by Andrew Yang, another competitor in this race. Why did Tubbs endorse Bloomberg?
Sure. It was very interesting because we had Mayor Tubbs on our California Nation podcast a couple months ago. And Stockton has this pilot program where through universal basic income for 18 months, 125 residents get $500 in cash, no strings attached. Andrew Yang's calling for $1,000 at a national level for all Americans. And the thing that Tubbs doesn't like about that plan is that it would force some people to choose between their existing benefits like food stamps or the $1,000 a month check. And Tubbs really wants universal basic income in addition to some of these support programs. But going to the Bloomberg endorsement specifically, Tubbs just thinks Bloomberg's the best to talk about poverty and address it. There's concerns with stop and frisk that you can get into. There's concerns about his wealth that you could get into. But ultimately, Tubbs feels that Bloomberg's policies on housing and poverty are what's most important.
Well, he did pledge to launch a so-called war on poverty. What does that mean?
Sure. So thinking about it in California terms, California has a huge affordability crisis when it comes to housing and building new housing, building affordable units. And yesterday, what Bloomberg unveiled was a California-focused housing plan that discussed Section 8 vouchers. And under this program, you can get a government subsidy, and the federal government gives a check essentially to a landlord. But in California, many people are finding it difficult to find landlords who will accept those vouchers in the first place, and there's a limited number of vouchers in existence. So what Bloomberg's calling for is expanding the number of vouchers as well as the access. And Bloomberg's also calling for a new source of funding to eliminate zoning restrictions, especially in transit areas, which is currently under consideration in California's legislature through Senate Bill 50. So those are some of the ways that he would tackle poverty through a housing lens.
And his strategy politically is to go all in California, right? Because it's too late for him to make inroads in places like Iowa or Nevada or New Hampshire. Is that a winning strategy to focus on California?
Well, I'm sure Californians like to focus on California, but as far as a pathway to securing the Democratic Party nomination, if you look at recent history, you have to win Iowa, New Hampshire, or both. And if you can't do either of them, you don't get the party's nomination historically. So skipping these four early states, Iowa caucuses, New Hampshire, Nevada, South Carolina, and going direct to California can be risky because usually you capitalize on these four states to build momentum. But California is the most delegate-rich state. At the end of the day, to get the nomination, you have to win delegates. So that's the strategy for Bloomberg, and time will tell if it'll pay off, but it's certainly unprecedented.
Hmm. Does that mean we are going to be seeing endless Bloomberg ads on TV?
So, seeing endless or less?
Endless. many.
Endless ads. Well, I think Californians have seen quite many ads so far from the Bloomberg campaign, and with a virtually limitless supply of money, there's not really much reason to suspect there will be fewer ads for Bloomberg. He's really trying to introduce himself to voters. And with California, if you have a huge cash advantage, you can get your name out there through a lot of these TV ads. So looks like they're going to still be going for the foreseeable future.
And do you think that he has his eyes on Kamala Harris's supporters, either her endorsers, her political supporters, or her voters?
Well, I think everyone does, especially Joe Biden. He's nabbed endorsements from former Kamala Harris supporters, and everyone would like more supporters and endorsements. If you look right now, there's still people fighting for Eric Garcetti. Now they're going to be fighting for Jerry Brown and Gavin Newsom and these top big California names. And Kamala Harris had dozens of state lawmakers support her campaign that are still up for grabs. Biden and Bloomberg seem to be really trying to snatch those endorsements the most from what I've seen, but certainly it's up in the air for everyone.
Brian Anderson covers politics and the 2020 election for the Sacramento Bee. Thanks, Brian.
Thanks for having me. Great time.
Coming up, why President Trump issued an executive order targeting anti-Semitism on college campuses. That's next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
This is our message to universities. If you want to accept the tremendous amount of federal dollars that you get every year, you must reject anti-Semitism. It's very simple.
President Trump in the East Room of the White House yesterday signing an executive order designed to combat anti-Semitism on college campuses by closing a loophole in the 1964 Civil Rights Act that prevents discrimination based on race, color, or national origin, not religion, though. Supporters argue it'll help stem a rising problem of anti-Jewish violence in this country. Critics, though, say it basically stifles free speech of anyone on college campuses who criticizes Israel. Zach Beauchamp joins me now. He's a senior correspondent for Vox, and he wrote about this. Hi.
Hey, how are you doing?
Great, thanks. Well, what are the details in this executive order?
Right. What Trump is doing in the executive order in terms of actual practical law is basically codifying an interpretation, this idea that if you are Jewish and you are targeted for anti-Jewish violence, that could potentially qualify under Title VI, even though religion isn't listed. And that the fact that someone is targeted for being perceived as being Israeli if they are Jewish, you know, if they're called Zionist or something like that and then beaten or attacked or something, or even, you know, discriminated against in university functioning on the basis of some kind of perceived allegiance to the state of Israel, that would qualify as anti-Semitism.
Okay, so basically this could justify the administration cutting funding from universities that allow protests against Israel on their campus?
Yeah, it depends on what the protesters say or what the examples are. It would be more likely that it wouldn't be an individual protest so much as, let's say, a chapter of Students for Justice in Palestine, the big national pro-Palestinian group on campus. Maybe a bunch of people in that group will say things that will offend Jewish students or that could qualify under the IHRA definition. And the Trump administration might, after this executive order, suspend funding from a university for not cracking down on such students and not limiting them, which, by the way, would probably be illegal or at least perhaps unconstitutional, depending on how you see it, on the university's part.
Because it would violate the First Amendment, right?
Correct.
So if little is going to change and implementation might be constitutionally suspect, why did he make this announcement?
As far as I can tell, the motivation for this is primarily political. The Trump administration has become increasingly aligned, as has the Republican Party as a whole, with a very hardline strand of pro-Israel advocacy that's largely linked to the political right. And this is connected to its embrace of the Netanyahu government, which is currently the most right-wing one in Israeli history. And this has led them to a lot of positioning on Israel, which is politically popular in the Republican base and with some fairly important donors who are in this world. For instance, Sheldon Adelson, a casino magnate who is one of the biggest Republican donors in the country, is maybe the leading person in this area supporting a far-right version of pro-Israel advocacy. And the Trump administration is trying to show these people that they care about their priorities. And a big one for these people is the rise of the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, BDS movement, which wants to push boycotts in Israel. And they see college campuses as a major organizing space for BDS and in a way that makes Jewish students and pro-Israel students feel uncomfortable. And they want to shut that down. So Trump signaling that he cares about this and then having his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, write an op-ed in the New York Times about it, suggests that, you know, he's on their side, he cares about their stuff, and he'll be able to count on them come re-election time in, you know, just a few months.
Yeah, and maybe he's looking at Florida as a key battleground state, and there are a lot of Jewish retirees there.
Correct. Trump has this fantasy in his mind that he can win over Jewish voters en masse. And while it's true that he's popular with a certain small subset of American Jews and some politically influential ones, it is just not the case that he will ever win over the majority of Jews who are quite progressive on a large slate of issues and are not going to be only one issue Israel voters, especially since his vision of how the U.S. and Israel should relate and what Israeli policy should be is not obviously the same as that of most Jewish Americans. Again, just a subset of American Jews. So you end up in this world where Trump has repeatedly said he thinks he can win over Jews. I think the exact movement at one point that he promoted was called Jexodus, for Jewish exodus, as if that wasn't already redundant, given that we exodused once from Egypt. And so this whole Jexodus fantasy has been a major part of Trump's rhetoric surrounding Jews and Israel stuff. And so I think he genuinely believes that he can win over Jewish voters with moves like this, even though it is strategically much more likely to enhance his standing with only a small subset.
Well, speaking of elections, I just want to turn quickly to Britain. Elections happening today. Many British Jews are really at a loss as to how they should vote because traditionally they would vote Labour, but they're now increasingly seeing Labour as anti-Semitic. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's a really weird situation. So Jeremy Corbyn, the current leader of Labour, has been, associated with the most radical pro-Palestinian factions inside Labour and has given rise to an epidemic of some hate speech that borders on being anti-Israel but comes across as being anti-Semitic, and some that are just straight up anti-Semitic. And it's become a real problem inside Labor. So you have the situation where Labor voters who were split, but in the last few elections, majority favoring conservatives, have now, according to the current polling, gone overwhelmingly to the conservatives. One pre-election poll showed something like 92-94% of British Jews were going to vote for the conservatives, an unheard of number in British politics, all over fears that Labour had been taken over and institutionally corrupted by anti-Semitism, fears that are not entirely unfounded. And in fact, there's a lot of good evidence that Corbyn has personally, or at least his office, has personally suppressed anti-Semitism inquiries and tried to sideline and shunt the issue. So while he himself is not the worst offender in the party, or not even close, and has said some things that are sort of questionable, quite bad in some instances, but tricky. The bigger problem is the institutional climate of Labour, and that is giving British Jews a hard choice, especially since Labour is the party that you would vote for if you're opposed to Brexit, and by a 2-to-1 margin, British Jews voted to stay in the European Union, whereas the Conservative Party, which they've been supporting recently, didn't. And you would think, under those circumstances, given that British politics are entirely realigning around Brexit, that Jews would vote, swing back to Labour again. But that doesn't seem to be what's happening. We'll know more after the election.
Well, Zach, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Zach Beauchamp from Vox. Coming up, a new feature film tells the real-life story of the women, led by Gretchen Carlson, who brought down Roger Ailes at Fox News.
Gretchen never got to work as an anchor woman again after she sued Roger Ailes anywhere. You know, no one picked her up.
A conversation with the director of Bombshell, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Roger Ailes died a broken and disgraced man. He had built Fox News, helped men like Ronald Reagan, George Bush, and Donald Trump become president. But then, 3 years ago, he was stripped of his power, kicked out of Fox News.
We're following some breaking news. Roger Ailes has resigned as the chairman and CEO of Fox News after a series of sexual harassment allegations.
It all started with Gretchen Carlson, the former Fox and Friends co-host. She had filed a lawsuit accusing Ailes of sexual harassment. An internal investigation was launched, and 20 more women came forward with allegations that Ailes harassed them. One of them, Megyn Kelly, the most powerful female anchor at Fox News at the time. And here she is talking about being sexually harassed by Ailes when she was just starting out in her TV career.
It culminated in a physical attempt to be with me, which I rejected in his office. And then I contacted a lawyer. He tried to kiss me 3 times. So I rejected that. And when I rejected that, he asked me when my contract was up.
The story of Kelly, Ailes, and sexism at Fox is now a movie. It's called Bombshell, starring Charlize Theron as Megyn Kelly, Nicole Kidman as Gretchen Carlson, and John Lithgow as Roger Ailes. Jay Roach directed the movie, and he joins me now in the studio. Welcome.
Oh, good to be here. Thank you.
Well, directing a movie about sexual harassment against women at Fox News, did you ever think that maybe you, as a guy, were not the right man for that?
Or the right person.
The right person.
It definitely crossed our minds. I would never have done it if I wasn't asked by Charlize Theron and then required that she be my producing partner on it. So I get the title director, but we all made this film together. There was a huge collaborative group that was involved. I'm usually pretty collaborative anyway, but in this case, I at least knew enough to know what I didn't know and how much I needed to listen. And we had incredible cast. You know, these women were all very serious about getting it right, about doing the research, about sharing their own stories and having, you know, figuring out where their stories overlapped with the stories of the women they were playing. So, you know, there was no way I was going to do it as some sort of, you know, male kind of stereotypical director. I know what we should all be doing. We were all in it together the whole time.
What do you mean by their stories overlapping with the characters they played?
I mean by the fact that they all, almost every woman that I talk to now, and it's, you know, it's again something that's eye-opening for men, is that most women have a story, particularly in our business, about some form of harassment. And if they don't, they have very close friends, direct knowledge of harassment. So these actors were often able to draw from experiences they had while portraying these women who also had similar experiences. So that was, I mean, the best example is when in our film, Roger Ailes is harassing Kayla, a composite character played by Margot Robbie. The level of just intensity and vulnerability, the scene starts so light and goofy. That's what Roger would often do, is sort of be charming and charismatic. And then over a few minutes, he gets her to, in her sort of audition process, begin to cross lines she never intended to cross. And by the time she does, she starts to realize where it's going, this incredible sense of victimization, but also shame, which is, again, something men just, I just don't think we understand how that happens.
Mr. Ailes, I'd appreciate it if you didn't mention
of course. I'm here to help my employees, not hurt them. Anything that happens here in this room is strictly between you and me.
Okay.
Of course, it cuts both ways. I'm discreet, but unforgiving.
It was just, I don't know, it was just to empathize with Kayla's character through Margot and what she was doing, and to experience John as intensely as we did, it just was really upsetting. So Charlize came up to and just gave her a really big hug at the end. She was crying, you know, and we were all pretty emotional after it. And I only did it for a couple takes. We realized something, maybe the most intense scene I've ever been involved in, had just happened through these two great performers.
Kayla is a composite, as you say,
yeah,
but she does embody some of the real stories that happened. Some of those stories you don't tell in this movie that are very shocking. Stories of rape, really.
Let's absolutely
be honest about it. Yeah. What it is. Why did you choose not to go that far?
I thought that what she goes through in that scene is what happens so often in so many situations. And yes, the other things happen too, but this is the kind of harassment that I just don't think gets enough attention. I just don't think, especially again, I don't think men really understand. You just hear, oh, someone was walked into a room, like you said, oh, how she's dressed. She has that voiceover at the end. You're condemned to ask, what did I wear? What did I say? And I think it's often diminished or, you know, trivialized in some way. And when you see how soul crushing what goes on in that room is, you go, oh my God, I didn't. And men come up after our screenings and say this very thing. I thought I sort of knew what was at stake in these situations and how this went, but this sort of almost mundane predation, you know, is to me almost was more interesting. And I thought the rest would also be very powerful too, but through Margot's description on the phone when she calls Kate McKinnon and confesses what happened, I thought that might even be more brutal in a way than somehow showing it. And you would always, if you showed it, you would be sort of exploiting it. You couldn't help but... You know what I mean? Like at making, that would be a sort of, it would have its own power as the sexuality. And it's so much more about power than that, than sexuality. And so it's always a tough call what, you know, how that would be interpreted.
Let's talk about Charlize Theron playing Megyn Kelly. And I just want to play a clip from the movie of her as Megyn.
It's like we're telling women, go on, speak up for yourself, just know. The entire network is with Roger. No one will believe you. They'll call you a liar.
So a lot of the movie focuses on her. And as we've said in the introduction, she has said that she was sexually harassed, but way before this movie takes place.
Right.
A lot of it centers on her relationship as the sort of the female face of Fox News mm-hmm. during the 2016 campaign. And during that infamous moment in the campaign where Donald Trump attacks her after she
confronts him.
Yeah, mm-hmm. she confronts him mm-hmm. quite strongly in the right. debate about his right. history belittling women. And then he comes out with the famous, she's got blood coming out of her, whatever. How did that fit into the overall picture of Roger Ailes and Fox News?
That's a really great question. It gets to exactly what drew me into this story when I first read the script, because I remembered that moment. And so the star of their network is taking on the new cash cow of the network. And I wondered, what do Roger Ailes and the Murdochs think about this? I mean, they got to make a decision now, because at first I thought, is this just kind of the professional wrestling of that kind of news situation? But I felt there was something, she seemed really sincere. And then the fact that he attacked her so relentlessly, you realize, okay, this was not a game. This is...
Well, she was afraid for her physical safety, right?
Absolutely.
Death threats and all sorts of threats.
It was horrible and we portray this in the film. So anyway, I wondered what it was like being in those rooms when those men are trying to figure out how are we going to handle all this? Whose side are we going to pick? And then they ended up pushing her to do that sort of lame, make good interview, which we also talk a lot about mm-hmm. in the movie.
Where she interviews Trump and they kind of
exactly.
bury the hatchet.
Yeah, and she kind of lets him off the hook after months of horrible harassment on via Twitter, So it's very common for me in these stories that I want to figure them out. I want to go back in a time machine and like, well, how did that happen? And who made that decision? And the choices, the dilemmas that I pictured, I think for me, stories need a great predicament for me to care about working on them for a long time and then believing I can tell you or anybody about it later. And even as you described what happened back then, as I was listening to your description of the history of this, I was like, that's a good story. That's what you just described. And that's how we have told it.
Well, all of it is such a good story. It's almost, why did you choose to make a feature film about it rather than a documentary? Because the facts are basically as or more dramatic than anything you could make up.
Partly because a really great woman documentarian had already done it. It's called Divide and Conquer by Alexis Bloom. And it's a great documentary. I highly recommend it.
We've
about this very story.
Her
yeah.
On the story so there program you go. About it.
Yeah. So I didn't want to make another one. Uh-huh. And actually talked to her quite a bit about it. And she put us in touch with some of the people she had spoken to. And she said this really inspirational thing to me. She said, you can do things I couldn't do. And you can, for example, portray characters that couldn't speak. She had read the script by then. She said, and what you're doing with Kayla is exactly what I'm talking about. You're taking stories that can't really be told and telling them because you're interpreting it. You're trying to get at the essential truth of what happened, but a documentary camera could have never been there, and those women didn't talk on camera. It is sometimes what a narrative film can attempt to do. Though also right away, and we say this to the audience quite clearly, even by sort of breaking the fourth wall and say, look, this is a construct, what we're doing. This is an interpretation, a dramatization. You have to be skeptical while you watch this, because some of this, we say even a disclaimer right off the top, there will be time compressions and composite characters. And I think it's really important to say that, but then also say, but we're going to try to get it right. We're going to try to do something authentic. And we're going to, hopefully you'll feel by the way we cast the movie, especially to cast such great actors who try so hard to get to the essence of what each character went through. I hope the audience feels like we cared very much about that aspect of it.
So now, cut to now, and you have Gretchen Carlson and Megyn Kelly are no longer with the network.
Gretchen never got to work as an anchor woman again after she sued Roger Ailes anywhere. No one picked her up, which is an incredible part of the price people pay when they speak up. Rudy Bakhtiar, who is a journalist we portray early in the film, where you hear her thoughts as she's being harassed by this guy, and you hear her trying to decide, how am I going to placate this jerk while I'm escaping this? She was fired in 2006. She was a great sort of seen as the next Christiane Amanpour on CNN. She gets a 3-year deal at Fox. 6 months in, this guy harasses her. She doesn't even report it. She just mentions it to a friend who mentions it to somebody higher up, and she gets fired because she was harassed, never works in broadcasting again. Mm. So
and Megyn Kelly went to another network,
well, yeah, and
that didn't
work out. Women of better power sometimes get better opportunities. But yeah, she as we say in the film, once you worked at Fox, you know, it's part of that Fox approach to news and opinion is in your DNA, and it's very tough to escape that.
Yeah, and I guess so. I guess I was left wondering, well, Megyn Kelly chose to go to Fox. She chose to play by this in this field. She espoused some, let's say, controversial views on air that she didn't necessarily have to say.
Yeah.
Did she believe them? I don't know.
It's hard to, you know, it's hard. I read her book, and she made a career, I think, especially in... you know, going after political correctness as a, you know, as a one of the bigger problems, and that was Fox's thing. She did a lot of very interesting things on her other show. I really, at least, was very interested in Ronan Farrow's account of when she got fired, how much it was definitely related to some of the racially insensitive things she said, but it was also related to the fact that she was complaining to her bosses about them suppressing Ronan's stories, you know, about Weinstein and also mm-hmm. Matt Lauer. It's one of the things I like to try to figure out with these films is nobody is as simple. There's so much more to everybody's story than what the media portrays and even how they portray themselves. There's so much more to Megyn Kelly even than how she portrays herself. And that's what Charlize helped me figure out. She really got that and really was... committed to trying to figure out where her stories overlap with Megan's.
Well, it's a fascinating story, great movie. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Really great conversation.
Jay Roach, director of the new movie Bombshell, in theaters tomorrow. Harvey Weinstein has reached a tentative settlement with more than 30 women he allegedly assaulted, $25 million, with no woman receiving more than $500,000. Weinstein won't have to admit any wrongdoing or pay the victims personally. The insurance companies representing the Weinstein Company will pay. Weinstein is still scheduled to be tried on criminal charges in January. And yesterday, a state judge doubled his bail to $2 million after he was accused of mishandling his ankle monitor. Joining me to talk about all this is Kim Masters, host of KCRW's The Business. Hey.
Hey. Oh, it was an accident, Madeline. His lawyer said he didn't know the monitor, and so he just vanished we don't know.
So he was not being monitored.
He was not being monitored repeatedly, yes. And the judge apparently thought his bail needed to go up a lot.
So he had to pony up another million. Okay. Does he have money?
You know, it's an interesting question. Of course, he made millions of dollars running Miramax and the Weinstein Company. But it's expensive to have a criminal trial. I mean, anybody who's ever gotten to anything that involves a lawyer knows you watch the money flow away from you. And so he's not... And this tentative deal that you're just talking about, he's not paying. In fact, part of the thing that is infuriating to a lot of people is the fact that not only is he's not paying the settlement money, but some of this global settlement that they're trying to work out of all of these claims against him, including many women, is that his legal fees would be covered for the civil litigation. So he doesn't even pay to defend this. This is all Weinstein Company insurers paying for this.
Why would the women sign on to this? It doesn't sound like a great deal for them.
Because litigating is really, really difficult, and they don't know that they have any other options. I mean, I will quote Catherine Kendall, an actress who had an allegation of misconduct against him dating back to 93. I mean, for a number of these women, the statute of limitations is up. They can't go for a criminal mm-hmm. allegation. If they're looking for any kind of compensation for the alleged behavior, this civil settlement is what they're going to get. And she said, you know, I don't love it, but I don't know how to go after him. I don't know what I can do. And I think that sense of helplessness is afflicting a lot of the women. And a couple of them have said, we're going to challenge this. This is not okay.
So if they challenge it, this is a tentative agreement.
It needs approval from a couple of judges, yeah.
Yeah, so if they challenge it, does those two or a couple, whoever's challenging it, does that then nullify the whole thing, or do they just do something separately?
I think it could potentially upend it. I'm not a lawyer, but that's my understanding. Mm-hmm. So this is not a done deal. But, you know, what's so frustrating, too, is even if this is a done deal, there was a time when this fund was supposed to be a lot bigger and there was going to be a settlement then that got upended. And little by little, there's less and less money. The Weinstein company's in bankruptcy. All kinds of people have all kinds of claims. It just is a real case study in the imperfections of the justice system.
Mm-hmm. So meanwhile, this criminal trial is going forward. This is unrelated, I guess, to the civil trial,
right,
to civil settlement, I should say. And so that involves two women out of the, you know, dozens and
who
dozens
knows?
Who have
yeah,
accused
many.
Him.
I mean, more could still come forward,
right.
Honestly.
Yeah, I guess so. So, but two definitely are going to be testifying.
They're going to be the people, the accusers in this lawsuit. I think other people will be allowed to testify, which may be helpful to the prosecution. Yeah. This is what happened with Bill Cosby. You know, he was not convicted until prior victims who were maybe outside the statute of limitations were allowed to testify. So there will be other testimony. You know, there's been discussion that these cases are hard to win. Lawyers can make a lot out of a little. And oftentimes in these situations, it's not like the behavior of a victim is like they suddenly slap you and run out of the room screaming. So they might make something out of somebody sending them an email saying, you know, thanks for the whatever. And then all of a sudden that shows that they consented to something. That's his position, that everything was consensual.
And so one of the women in this says that he allegedly raped her.
Right. And there are rape victims in the settlement too, alleged rape victims. Yeah.
Another one, a serious sexual assault allegation against him. I think these charges carry a life sentence.
I don't know that he will get a life sentence or any. We have no idea. I mean, I think that for women who potentially would be part of the settlement, settling for some, let's say you're one of the victims who alleges that she was raped, no matter what the allegation is, these are traumatizing events. But obviously, to get a maximum of $500,000 and say, sorry, I don't know, that covers the kind of, you know, even the therapy bills from what you would need to try to deal with this. So I don't know that there's going to be an outcome. I think it will be cathartic for a lot of people if there's any jail time. There has to be a conviction and jail time. If not, we saw this whole thing kick off the Time's Up movement and a real revolution around the world in 2017. I argue it hasn't gone nearly far enough, but because we've really only seen the most egregious people caught up in this net. There's all kinds of garden variety stuff that might not even be legally questionable, but is still discriminatory in effect. So I just think, you know, if he walks free, I don't know whether women will then feel completely defeated or energized to continue this revolution that started with the Time's Up movement.
Yeah, I guess what does it say when the poster boy, if you will, for the most egregious acts is somehow not paying a dime of his own personal money, could conceivably be found not guilty in a criminal trial? What does that say about all the other cases?
Yeah, well, I take some comfort, I admit, from the fact that R. Kelly is in jail right now. So, you know, I'm sure there are people who would say there's a racial element to that. Why is he in jail while Harvey Weinstein gets to screw around and forget how to use his ankle monitor? But at least that, given the egregiousness of those allegations and the years and years of the multiple victims and the youth, I guess we'll draw our consolation where we can.
Kim Masters, she's host of KCRW's The Business and editor at The Hollywood Reporter. Editor at large. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, they is the word of the year, according to Merriam-Webster. I'll talk about that with my favorite grammarian, Benjamin Dreyer, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Every year, the Merriam-Webster Dictionary chooses one word that defines the year in culture. 2 years ago, it was feminism. Last year, it was justice. This week, we learned that this year's word is they. They. T-H-E-Y, they. The word received lots more Google searches than it did last year. Merriam-Webster updated the word's definition this year to include its use as a non-binary pronoun. So we have decided to call up our favorite language expert, Benjamin Dreyer, to explain the significance of they. He's copy chief at Random House and author of the best-selling book, Dreyer's English. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Well, what was your reaction to seeing they as the word of the year?
I was delighted. I thought it was a really great, bold choice. I'm glad they did it. One of the things that I've always appreciated about the Merriam-Webster people as they put out things on their account, as they put out their word of the day, is that they really do try to keep an eye on what's going on in the world. And sometimes they slyly comment on it. But in this particular case, I thought they did a really great thing by choosing a word that is so important to the evolution of how we communicate with one another and even how we look at one another, how we regard one another. So I thought it was a superb choice.
I'm just wondering, though, if it's slightly political, because when you look at all the other words that were runners up, they all had to do with impeachment, or pretty much all of them.
I think that it's what they say reflects what people are looking up. And so much of what people are looking up has to do with what's going on in Washington. I mean, I was delighted to see that one of the runners up was exculpatory. And it's a great word to learn. It's a great word if you don't know it to look it up. But I mean, they is a very important thing. I mean, it's a thing that a lot of people, whether they are working in the word business or not working in the word business, have had to wrestle with. For me, as a person who is in the word business, who was writing about words, who knew at some point I knew I was going to have to address the use of the word they as just basically a singular pronoun, and then also the additional non-binary use. I mean, I was sweating over it. It's difficult. It's tricky. It's fraught. It's sensitive. You want to do the right, well, I mean, not everybody wants to do the right thing, but I wanted to do the right thing, and I wanted to get it right. I'm glad that they're there trying to get it right as well.
So why were you sweating? Why is it so difficult to just sprinkle they in instead of he or she?
Well, approaching the word they on two levels, one which is the simple use of the word as a singular, mm-hmm. As in a student should be able to study whatever they want. Mm-hmm. It's always been difficult for me as a copy editor to wrap my brain and to wrap my ear around it, mostly because I was trained not to use it. I was trained to think that it was just sort of sloppy. Now, what can easily be argued, and people always will leap in to say this, is that they has been used as a singular pronoun in the English language for hundreds and hundreds of years. That is absolutely true. But for those of us of a certain age who were raised reading English as it was published through much of the 20th century, that sort of thing was not used. When I was looking for examples, I remember running to a book about a book by Anna Freud. I thought, oh, well, it'll be interesting to see what a Freud has to say about this. And she was talking about raising children and exclusively was using the pronoun he, as if to say that, you know, a default child can be referred to as a he. And only when she was specifically referring to girls would she pull up the word she. But you will see that not just in Anna Freud's book, but in all sorts of writing by all sorts of people as it was published in those decades. One thing I find delightful is I have this old book that I just love because I like these sort of old etiquette books. It's a Vogue's book of etiquette from the 1920s. Its pronoun of choice for infants whose gender is not particularly important to the conversation is it.
That says it all about Vogue.
Yes.
But let me just ask you that. So then after we decided we can't just default to he, we decided to use he or she, which is also clunky.
Right. And writers, you know, when I got into the copy editing biz, you know, in the 1990s, writers were really trying to figure out how to work through this. So there was a lot of he or she. There was a vogue for alternating the use of the pronoun paragraph by paragraph, which can be a little dizzying. There was a brief use of S/HE, which is so visually unappealing that it was a really good thing that it went away very quickly.
You can't say that out loud.
Yeah, I mean, you can't say it. So you would do things, if you were I, you would do things to recast the sentence so that maybe you didn't need a pronoun at all.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be a little tricky, but it was doable. But a long time ago, I recognized that defaulting to he was just not going to cut it anymore. And I think that it's bad writing
so
nowadays. And I think that people who still do that are doing it in a provocative way.
Yeah. Oh, I see. So you think they're being political by doing
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I do.
Why does it have to be political?
Oh, gosh, isn't everything?
Well, it seems that way these days.
Right. But it does take time. The bit of reaction that I have seen to the Merriam-Webster naming they as the word of the year, I mean, people who are interacting with me online at Twitter interact with me civilly. So we've been having some sort of civil conversations. But if you go look at some of the commentary that the Merriam-Webster people have gotten themselves, it's a lot of it is negative and hostile. And I think that negativity and that hostility is political.
Mm-hmm.
It's taking a stance against recognition of anything other than you got your he's over here and your she's over there, and that's the end of it.
Although it can be confusing, let's admit.
It is confusing, and it can be confusing, and it can be personally difficult. I recognize my own difficulty with it when I gained my first colleague here who was non-binary. And when that colleague was introduced, with the pronoun they. And it took me a while to get it through my head. And I spent weeks doing everything I could to only refer to my colleague as my colleague. It was getting a little silly. And finally, one day, the word they popped out of my mouth. And truly, I thought, oh, thank God that's over. But I don't want to be one of those people who will jump up onto the stage and say, everybody get in line and do this and do it now. And it is easy and it is uncomplicated and get with the program. It is tricky. It is difficult. There can be some confusion when you are referring to one particular person as they, because we're used to they as a plural pronoun.
Mm-hmm.
You just kind of have to address it and think about it.
Benjamin Dreyer is Random House copy chief and author of the New York Times bestseller, Dreyer's English. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm joined by my colleague, Michelle Alloy, now.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm here to give feedback.
I'd love to hear some.
So yesterday we talked a little bit about McKinsey, the consulting giant that current South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg works
current
for.
And current candidate
so
for
we
president.
Asked current candidate for president. We asked listeners if they think the fact that he worked for McKinsey is problematic, and if in general they have a problem with candidates working in the private sector before they transition over to the public. Nancy Foster says, I think it's a very good thing to have a president with a range of experience, not just politics. John Hill says, aren't we all guilty of living in a country that still is part of an endless war, climate misinformation, and a president who's currently violating the Constitution? Stacey Saley says, not a problem. It wasn't illegal. People get to have jobs. Amy Beam says, our current president grabbed them by the word we cannot say on the radio. So the bar has been set. But Christopher Breyer says, depends on the candidates, policies, and behavior. Mayor Pete fails both tests.
Wow. Okay. A range of opinions.
A range of opinions.
On the mayor from South Bend.
Exactly.
All right. Well, thank you. Michelle Aloy, and thank you for listening. I'm Madeline Brand, and I will see you tomorrow.